employees. This is Thursday, February 28th, and we have our honorable chairwoman, Senator Torres Ray, to present her bill, Senate File 261. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about an issue that you all have been talking about. And you heard this morning that we got a report that came from the Department of Human Services, and really probably Sue can tell us more about the situation that we are facing in terms of the type of neglect that we have had of mental health services throughout the years and how we found significant problems in the systems that exist today that support people with mental illness. Members, I know that this is a difficult task for us to do because we have to figure out where we establish priorities, how do we allocate our funding to do the work that we need to do in education, and we have to make choices. But I think throughout session you have heard that we are facing significant challenges with kids that come to the schools with tremendous challenges, and they are not receiving the support that they need from their families because their families don't have health plans, because their families cannot afford to pay for treatment, because their families cannot recognize the challenges that these children are facing. So what I am asking members is that we begin to look at how do we support children in the schools, how do we begin to really understand how we could educate kids about these challenges. And the proposal before you is to provide mental health instruction for kids, for students in grades 6 through 12. And clearly this responsibility will be the commissioner's responsibility to align with local health and physical education standards and integrate this mental health curriculum into existing curriculum. The bill also asks for really reviewing what is appropriate because clearly we have to review a process and curriculum that is appropriate for ages six, for grades, you know, end of elementary school, middle school, and then as they enter high school. And an important element in here, members, is really to provide kind of a directory of resources. I think part of what we don't have in the schools right now is access to the information and the resources that already exist. The resources are not sufficient, but parents and kids are usually confused about, you know, where to go, and many times they are in crisis and they don't know really where to go. So this bill will attempt to engage the department and different districts in this conversation and begin to get some support. I am incredibly happy to have two people with me who can speak about really the more professional experience and the work that NAMI has been doing with different providers, talking to schools, students, and parents, and really gathering the support and build the collaboration that is needed in order to move this forward. And we have tremendous support right now from different members who have been part of the coalition who are moving about, I think, seven bills. And this is 12. And this is one of them. So I hope that, you know, we are successful today. And I also have Jessica with us, who is a student who is going to talk to you about her own experience and the experiences that she knows about other students.
Thank you, Senator Torres Ray. And I'd like to the tape to reflect that we do have a quorum now.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Ms. Abderholden.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. As I think you've heard us say many times during this session, early identification and treatment is very, very important. Excuse me. We think that youth especially in middle school and high school, which is around when mental illnesses begin to emerge, that they understand mental illnesses, that they understand the early warning signs, that they understand what they need to do. We know that if we educate young people about mental illnesses, we actually reduce the stigma. And even the U.S. Surgeon General has said that you could take a look at all the different barriers that exist in terms of insurance and everything else, but the largest barrier we have to seeking treatment is actually the stigma surrounding mental illness. So the more we know about it and the more we talk about it, the more we break down that particular barrier. And that's particularly true around psychosis. There was actually a pilot project out in Oregon that actually provided just a little bit of education in the schools about psychosis, which, as you know, can be one of the most if it turns into schizophrenia, one of the more devastating illnesses. And they had young people coming forward and saying, you know, I am hearing voices, and I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know if this was normal or not. And so then they were able to intervene early and provide the support and the treatment that that young person needed. I think it also will help in terms of reducing the suicide amongst our young people. So if they really understand what the signs and symptoms are, if they know what to do, if they have a fellow student or a friend who's going through this, we'll be able to kind of unearth this and be able to have a discussion about it. As Senator Torres Ray said, it's important that the education be age appropriate and that it's based on research. There's actually a wrong way to teach young people about suicide. And so we want to make sure that the research is informing that. It's not just somebody in the community who says, oh, I can come in and talk about that. We really want to make sure there's research behind it so that we are preventing suicides and not encouraging them. I did look up the national health standards and the Minnesota benchmarks to it. It's a wonderful document if you need something to read it late at night. And what I found is that there, while mental health is in there, in terms of the actual activities and the that they have suggested, there are only three tiny points in the whole document that give examples of how you can learn about mental illness. So that said to me, we don't have enough examples in here and enough ideas to help our schools really go forward with that. The other thing I just wanted to mention is that I did talk with Glennis Edwall last night from the Department of Human Services, head of the Children's Mental Health Division. She is totally on board. She said she would work, you know, we would work together so the department doesn't have to do the research on what is the curriculum that's out there. One of them that's actually very good and free, I want to just underline the free part, is from the National Institute of Health, and it's a whole curriculum on the brain and mental illnesses for grades 6 through 8, and they have other grade levels as well. So we have really good materials that are already existing, so we're not asking, again, schools or the department to come up from scratch. I do want to mention that we had similar language that actually passed in 2010. Some of you who are here might remember that bill kind of died and never really went anywhere. There were just a few tiny differences, which the big thing was must or may, and we just feel that at this time with the crisis we feel like we're facing with children's mental health, we really should be requiring schools to include some education about mental illness. Lastly, I just want to say that, you know, you've heard from teachers, from principals, from superintendents about the mental health needs of our students, and the students that they serve, and how they want to make sure that everyone understands those early warning signs. And I think that if we omit students from this piece, we are omitting a huge part of how we can really intervene early and protect them and have them have a good outcomes out of their education. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica.
Senator Torres Ray, would you like to continue with testimony or ask
questions? Thank you. Question? I would like to invite Mrs. Snyder to continue with the testimony, Madam Chair.
Jessica Snyder Carderell?
You got it. Second
okay.
try.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Torres Ray and Chairwoman Committee members, my name is Jessica Snyder Carderell. I attend Minneapolis South High as an 11th grade student. And I'm here because I personally have struggled with mental illness, and I'm still struggling with the long-term effects today. My eating disorder developed in late 7th grade, and I was unaware of what I was feeling was normal, and it turns out it wasn't. I had no idea who to turn to, and I felt isolated, so I kept my feelings to myself. And unfortunately, my mental health worsened, as most cases do if it goes untreated. Had I known that what I was experiencing was a sign of an eating disorder, I may have been spared some of the physical scars that remain in my body today if I had the opportunity to get help before I needed drastic intervention. I'm testifying for the kids who will be diagnosed with mental illness in the next year and for those who are silently struggling today. As a student that has attended and still attends standardized health class, I have full authority to attest to the minimalistic coverage of mental illness. As I walked into my health class just this morning, I was handed a simple word find with vocabulary words pertaining to mental illness. Beyond this assignment, I was asked to define 5 mental illnesses, and that is the extent of our curriculum. 2 semesters of health class are required for graduation. And because this is a requirement, you as senators hold the power to change curriculum, which could result in changing and saving lives. We must include more curriculum in both middle school and high school, and I strongly support Senate File 261. If we could spare even one child from suffering because of the added curriculum, it would be money well spent. If we were to educate more students about mental health, we could reduce the rates in which young adults drop out of high school, increase the rates of attendance, thus increasing graduation rates. My high school, as a side note, has a meeting group called the Silver Ribbon Campaign. Every other week, hundreds of students gather to learn about illnesses, treatment, and effects of the mental illness. This shows that there is a thirst for more information, even in the young adult population. There is a hope that we have to reduce stigma, and added curriculum would be the natural next step. Anorexia, schizophrenia, bipolar, PTSD, depression, they all deserve to be acknowledged with our children in order for us to reduce stigma and allow children to get help before they turn to a razor, before they turn to a bottle of pills. Not only am I representing myself here today as someone who's personally suffered from mental illness, but I'm representing my fellow Native American students, Asian American students, African American students from South High School. We all struggle with mental illness, and we could all benefit from added curriculum.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica.
Any questions from the
Thank
committee?
You, members.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you very much for the testimony. You answered part of my question about what we do already, but in all these hearings and all these bills, one of my driving concerns and issues is parents. We talked about schools and what schools can do and how they help. But where do parents play a role here? It's to go to our parents and our family to say, you know, they got something wrong. Or mom, dad, I'm not doing so well. Now, there are obviously cases where mom and dad aren't in the situation to deal with that. But somewhere in here, you know, all the testimony here was nothing about parents and family. I'm working on that end of it. And if somebody's mentally ill, I'm not a health specialist, but my understanding from my reading and my brief encounters with it were that some people who are mentally ill don't realize it because they have a different reality, right? Schizophrenics and stuff like that. If you're in the school teaching them this is what schizophrenia is, or this is what anorexia is, well, they necessarily recognize it. But and lastly is, what's this? Are there no assessments before they go to school? So what do we do before? Are there any assessments? And where do parents and families fit in this whole process? And will this actually, do we think teaching kids about mental health, changing mental health as much as we teach kids about being thin and we have an obesity problem? So what do you think about the outcomes? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I think Jessica would like to talk a little bit about her experience at her parents, and then Ms. Arthur Holden will talk a little bit about the assessment piece.
Thank you.
Jessica. Senator, from my personal experience, when you're touching on the aspect of from a parent's point of view, my mother, as a single mom, also had that same problem. She had no idea what to do. And because when you're talking about warning signs, I don't look like I have an eating disorder. I don't look anorexic or emaciated. She had no idea what the signs were beyond being thin for an eating disorder. And because of the limited resources, once I told her that there was an issue, she turned to Google. And I think that right there is testimony to the fact that we need some sort of resource in the school beyond us one social worker to try to do the job for thousands of students.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Senator
Thank
Chamberlain.
Thank you, Jessica.
So we don't, because most mental illnesses start emerging, you know, there's some that emerge early. You know, we've had families come testify in human services where they knew as a toddler there was something that was very different. But we see more of it emerging when it's more like, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, those some of the symptoms start coming forward. So it's kind of hard to do a screening in school. What we do have is, you know, teachers receive education about the early warning signs of mental illness. They have the children for a large part of the day. And often it's difficult to really put things together until you talk about what the parent is seeing at home and what the teachers are seeing at school. And kids respond in different ways. So, for example, my daughter, who had depression and anxiety, would be perfectly fine in school. And because she just had this thing that you had to be good in school. And then she would come home, and by then her anxiety would totally erupt. And so what I was seeing at home was very different at school. And it can be the other way, too, where a child, the parent has kind of figured out how to keep the child calm and doing well at home, but the school in a busier, you know, environment can't adjust at all. So we really think it's important for the schools and parents come together. And the other thing is that, especially when it's emerging at, you know, especially in the high school level, having kids just understand what that is, I think is a really a good thing. We're not asking this curriculum to, you know, teach kids how to treat each other or anything like that, because that is the role of, you know, the school counselors to kind of do that, and social workers and nurses to do that kind of first screen, and then the school-linked mental health services are a way to make sure that kids can get access to that treatment, although we're clearly not in every school yet in the state of Minnesota. You know, we in looking at this, we do a lot of, in looking at the benchmarks, there's a lot of information about risky behavior, about the use of alcohol and drugs, about recognizing, you know, healthy eating, even infectious diseases. But, you know, again, very little about mental illnesses, which really impact, you know, 25% of our population in any given year. So it's really, you know, it's so common that we would want to make sure that kids kind of know, you know, this is a brain disorder. You know, it's not your fault. It's not anybody's fault. But I will tell you, we see parents actively involved. But sometimes you're just not, you know, if the student doesn't share that they're feeling suicidal to their parents, there's no way to know.
Members, one thing that I wanted to share with you is a little bit of history on this bill. I was invited 5 years ago to a meeting of the Silver Ribbon Commission in South High, and when I arrived to this room, there were about 75 kids, and I had to talk about mental illness, and I thought, how am I going to do this? How do I have 10, 15 minutes of meaningful conversation with 75 kids that were just really, you know, ready to talk about everything? And so I decided to form groups and ask them to tell me if they had a wish and they could make a decision about doing something about mental illness, what is that they will do. And actually, they recommended that we do this. They said that they needed more information, that they had friends, that they were facing some significant challenges and they didn't recognize, that many times they were disciplined by parents, by teachers in the schools, and for reasons that were so unfair, and it was related to the challenges that they were facing with mental illness and some issues, you know, related to depression in particular. In that group, there was a lot of conversation around about depression and how they didn't recognize the signs and they didn't understand their friends. And so out of that, we had this conversation, and we moved this bill before with bipartisan support, but that year we didn't have an education policy bill. The House and the Senate could not agree to it, so we could move it forward. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of history about the work that has taken place before today.
Thank you. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to respond a little bit to Senator Chamberlain's concern, which it's a very good concern to have in terms of where are the parents, but I would like to add that, you know, some parents, and I can attest to this, do go through denial when their child has mental illness. And we want to make sure that we don't replace the parent, of course, and the parents have a role in this whole discussion. But culturally speaking, and for many other reasons, some parents just won't admit that their child has a mental illness, no matter how old they are. So I would say we're not trying to replace the role of the parent. It's a very important role, but I think the state can and should do more to provide information so that kids who can be aware that they are in trouble can access the help they need. So this is a very important issue, and it affects more kids than you think. And I have many examples that I can point to personally.
Me?
No. I didn't mean it that way. But it happens more than you think.
We were all cowering a little bit, Senator Chamberlain.
It's a serious issue. It's a very serious issue. So I know it was joke. You know, we're joking here, but it's not an issue to joke with. This is kids' life, and it affects more people than we think. So I'm supportive of having that information, and I thank the testifier for being so courageous to share your story. So thank you.
Senator Chamberlain, and then Senator Nelson.
One last thing. Senator Torres-Ray, is it envisioned that this curriculum would be rolled into the current health classes that they're required to take? Is that the idea?
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is correct, Senator Chamberlain. So we will have, you know, to work with the commissioner to figure out how that works and how we, you know, coordinate that with existing curriculum.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Torres-Ray, and also your testifiers for sharing with us. We all know how important it is to have strong mental health programs and make sure that our students are getting access to all of the things that that are important in that regard. And my question has to do with, I'm wondering if you're going to have the school boards testify on this. I'd like to know what they think, and I'll tell you what I'm wondering about this is we know that we're continually asking our schools to do more, and we continue to pile on, and we continue to ask them to do more, and we put a lot of we're increasing our academics as well. So we're increasingly asking our schools to do more. They do have our students for 8 hours a day. And so many of these issues certainly are multi-pronged issues, and I understand here we're looking at the education piece of it. But I do have a copy here of the National Health Education Standards and Minnesota Benchmarks because I wanted to see what that entailed. And so my question has to do with one of resources and timing. There's 41 pages here in these benchmarks. And so what I want to know is, how is this going to impact our schools as far as being able to do all the other things that we ask them to do for timing, for the resources that they'd have for this? And then also, are we anticipating any type of cost?
I can answer.
So, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Nelson, you know, that is exactly a question I had with respect to kind of bringing this before you. So there are two things that I think could happen. Originally, I thought maybe I could ask to put a task force to come and work on this. But I think we have about 5 bills now that are asking for task forces. And I'm quite disappointed that, you know, we're asking people from the public and the districts and the staff from the department to come and, you know, just form committees and tell us, you know, what needs to be done. So on one hand, you know, I do appreciate that process because it brings the expertise. But NAMI has been convening people for a long time. This is not something that happened yesterday. So that work has been done. The other piece, Senator, is that we are in crisis right now. And you heard, you know, some testimony earlier that part of what happens is that we have kids that are coming through the schools with years of neglect on their mental health, you know, and well-being. So schools are having to pay a high price today for not providing this. So the argument that I make is that if we provide at least a minimal instruction about this issue. Schools are going to save money because we cannot hire more staff. Hiring the staff that we need will cost us a lot more. You know, if a young person like Jessica is able to understand, you know, a lot of our kids have access to mental health services through their health plans. The parents work, they have, but they don't recognize the signs. So we have a lot of discipline issues, a lot of academic issues, and a lot of staff problems that we're facing right now because kids and parents are just not able to recognize signs. So what we hope we can accomplish, Senator, with this is that we give that information, that kids begin to say, you know, to their parents, I have a class and I think this is my problem and I need to see somebody. We think that we're going to save money in the long term. Of course, we're going to meet Senator, this has to go to finance. So I am absolutely welcoming, you know, any feedback from the superintendents, the different districts, people who are here as to what do we need, you know, if we need to do it incrementally, if we do it, you know, by some grades first, how do we target that so that we don't impose a mandate without supporting our schools? I definitely agree with that.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Ray. You really got to the nub of my issue here. Is this another unfunded mandate on our schools, which are already struggling? So not at all am I at all talking about the importance of mental health. We all understand that. But my real question is towards implementation, and I would like to hear from the school districts or the school boards, can they implement this? And kind of really to what you're visiting about, which is that unfunded mandate aspect of it.
Madam Chair, Senator, if I might. So if you look at the benchmarks, like if you take page 23, for example, in the benchmarks, they list mental health. And then if you go over to some of the suggested activities, there's nothing in there at all that talks about mental health or mental illness. And so it's in there already, but there's no activities. And so what we'd like to be able to do is to take, for example, the NIH curriculum and say, well, here's some activities that you could do in this area to cover that current standard. I really was surprised as I read through that there were only three items that I could pick out that related to teaching youth about mental illnesses or mental health at all. So I think that there needs to be, and I'll admit it was during the tax committee in the House at 11 o'clock last night, and I might have missed one, but it was very few. Again, I think we just need some ideas that go out to them to say, here's some activities that you could do to meet the current benchmark. And here's things that are age appropriate. Here's things that are based on research so that they could go forward and do it. I did reach out to the School Board Association earlier this week to say, as soon as I found out the bill was coming up, you know, got any problems with it, and I don't know if they're in the room or not, and they can answer for themselves, but I do always try to reach out to people to see if they have any problems.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And members, it strikes me that the students are starting to educate themselves. As long as no one else is, I guess it's good that they are. And I'm interested in, I've never heard of the Silver Ribbon program, and I'm wondering who starts it. Did it just get named or what? So if you could tell me a little bit about that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I could tell you the origin of it. So Eva Newbeck behind me is the social worker at South High. And as it happens, we were both Suzuki moms at the same place, and so you spend hours and hours sitting there. Really hours all day Saturday. And so we got to talking, and she was talking about some of the struggles that her students were having. And she had two students who came forward, they both had relatives who lived with a mental illness and said, you know, we need to know more about this. Could we start a club? And so Nami and, well, myself and Eva worked together to create this club going, and it's been how many years, Eva? 10 years, and when I went this fall, there were more like 175 students who showed up, and we started with the first meetings. We'd have a group of, you know, 5 or 6 or 10 or 12, and I think the very cool thing about it is it's student-led, so they really are figuring out, you know, what do they want to learn about, what kind of speakers do they want to have, and I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Jessica.
Let me throw in one question, if you don't mind, before you respond, and that is it just about mental illness and health issues. Okay.
Chairwoman, thank you. Yes, Silver Ribbon Campaign, also known as SRC at our school. I heard about it 2 years ago. They were offering free bagels. So I went. The bagels have stopped because we have surpassed, I think our highest number was 263 students attended one session, and we could not fit everybody into a classroom. We have both student speakers. Myself was one of them this past January, but we also have many different types of professionals. Just yesterday, we had Wallstone Jr. yesterday talk about depression. And when I spoke, I told them, we have to put a cap on this because people attend in flocks. It is honestly a national model, what Eva Newbeck has done in our school. It has created such an amazing environment in our school for mental health that I felt comfortable coming forward to my friends and telling them, look, I have a problem.
And members, I thank you, Jessica. I am aware that, you know, oftentimes it's the kids who get to know that one of their friends has problems. Mm-hmm. And they are the ones who bring it to somebody if there's somebody around that's helpful. So it is really valuable to have students know about this because they're with their friends probably more than their parents are with their children at that stage in life. You know, when they're 15, 16 years old, they don't really, most of them at least, I didn't really care that much about hanging around me, but they were there for food and shelter and money. But thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill in the audience, or if you have someone, trust me. Oh, Mr. Piccolo, I'm sorry, you are on the agenda too.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Eugene Piccolo. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. First, I want to express our appreciation to Senator Torres Ray for bringing forth this legislation as a vehicle for discussing what needs to be done related to mental health education of our young people. Earlier this week, I asked our charter school directors across the state to share their thoughts about Senate File 261. Based on the response I received from our directors, I can say that all of our schools have young people who have mental health issues, and that there's agreement on the need that families, society, and the state need to do more to effectively respond to mental health issues. I can also say that our charter schools directors believe that schools do have a role in addressing mental health education of young people, and in fact, many of them have instruction and programs to address mental health already in place. While the response to the legislation is supportive, it also raised a number of questions, some philosophical, some policy, and some practical questions that they posed. So I'd just like to share a few of those questions. First, the question on a philosophical level, the question was raised is what should be the role of schools in addressing the mental health needs of our young people? If the primary mission of our schools is academic achievement, and the primary measure of our school success is on achievement on a standardized test, what is the appropriate way in which we assess schools in terms of dealing with mental health education? It also raises the question of what can be done to improve the connection between schools, families, and the mental health system in order to better assist young people that need those services. Second, what is it that we seek to achieve as a result of mental health instruction? Is it improving their knowledge level, their understanding, their skill? We know that addressing mental health needs and issues of young people, or adults for that matter, is not just about gaining knowledge, understanding, skills. It is also, more often than not, also providing them access to mental health professionals and mental health services. Third, What do our teachers need in terms of education and training relative to mental health issues to be able to effectively instruct and facilitate the age-appropriate learning activities that encompass mental health education? It was pointed out by one school director that if we do this poorly, mental health activities, like any other poorly facilitated activities, sometimes they can do more harm than good. So what is it that we need to do as a state to equip our educators with the tools they need to be effective in teaching mental health instruction? We believe that mental health education is an important element that needs to be addressed for our young people. But we also understand that instruction alone, without connecting that instruction to the mental health system and providing access to all of our kids to mental health professionals and their families, that the services of mental health system will not impact the overall state of mental health of Minnesota's young people. So we really urge you to look at not only the instruction, but also how do we help families connect to the services of mental health services that they desperately need to make this an impact on their lives. So again, we appreciate the opportunity and the forum for this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. Any questions from the members? If not, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak? I see a young woman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, members, Chair. My name is Snezhana Besanov, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota School Boards Association. And I wasn't gonna come and testify, but Senator Nelson, kind of brought us into the discussion. First of all, Senator Torres-Ray, thank you so much for bringing this forward. I really appreciate it. And appreciate Sue Abelhort. Okay, I thought my name was hard to pronounce.
Just Sue. For now, it's fine.
Thank you for reaching out. And we definitely, throughout the session, been doing weekly surveys to our members, and one of them was on mental health. And what I do want to point out that we surveyed, had about 226 members reply, and they did, overwhelmingly did say that they provide education and mental health. So some of our concerns would be, or questions really, not necessarily concern, would be in association to, how will this impact the current curriculum of those who do provide it? So that would be number one. And number two, as far as on page one, that is one, just one page, line seven, would that align with the current local health standards? Because that's the only standards that are local. Would it align with those? And I think that is a yes. But we would like some clarification because some schools just provide it in 8th grade and, in 12th grade or whatnot. So we just want to make sure it aligns with those and if it will impact the ability for local standards to continue to be set. Stuff, but definitely appreciate any kind of resources that the department can provide. So that's about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And Madam Chair, members, I absolutely, I think, a couple of issues that were said. One is whether or not this bill will address mental health and mental illness issues among students. And the answer is no. This bill is not attempting to do that. This bill is only attempting to incorporate into the standards education, information about mental illness. Whether or not that will ultimately, take care of the mental health needs of the state of Minnesota in this population, the answer is no, because what we need is to increase access, like Mr. Piccolo just said, and resources into this system. So this is an attempt to really provide some education, and most definitely, I don't want to put the department in the spot, but the job of the department will be to really look into. I'm pretty sure that some districts are doing some very creative things right now. My own district in a very large school that, as you know, was in the news recently, South has this kind of initiative that is initiated by students. So there are some outstanding models out there, people who are doing some great work in the districts. Absolutely, we need to incorporate that into what will be done next, and hopefully learn from those best practices and figure out how do we do that statewide.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. Senator Clausen. And if we, if it's a question for the school board representative, or is it a question? No. Okay.
Oh, just okay. Just kind of some comments in general. If I remember correctly, there are two courses that are generally required in the health area. The first one has to do with body systems, and the second one has to do with mental health, tobacco, alcohol, chemical use, nutrition, more of social issues. And there's another area in the curriculum I think that would be important to look at, and that is in the social sciences. Most schools offer a psychology course, and I think that would be another area potentially to look at as far as the benchmarks and see if these areas that you're concerned about would be covered. I think there is a teacher licensure requirement that teachers have to go through to get training on identifying mental illness. So that's in place, which I think is very good. I think one of the more difficult situations that I can recall in my professional career was dealing with a student that had some severe behavior issues that warranted that you were concerned having that student in the building. And then trying to get an assessment or trying to get that student into a mental health professional, you might wait a month to try to get an appointment. And that's a real concern. And I don't know how necessarily we address that, but I think additional mental health professionals in our community and our schools are greatly warranted. There were situations where you ask yourself, we cannot allow this student to be back in our greater population, but on the other hand, what do you do with that student for 4 weeks while you're waiting some kind of an assessment? So, just some comments, Madam Chair.
It appears as if Ms. Abderholden would like to respond to that comment. If go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, Senator Claussen, that's why we really like the school linked mental health grants, because it really does provide the mental health professionals in the schools very rapid access, which really does speed up that diagnostic assessment time. And excuse me, because they're a community mental health provider, even if the child is not in school, they can continue to serve them, which really makes it very nice. Because they're not an employee of the school district, they can serve a child wherever they may be. And many of them actually run day treatment programs as well, so if that's what the child needs, they can rapidly get them in there. I would agree we're at many school districts, about 17% of schools, which is pretty high, but we're not there yet in terms of hitting all of them.
Thank you. And one comment I'd like to make, because I think you all know that I have a great interest in this area too, because as the superintendents and principals have told us very clearly that these issues are disrupting many children's academic learning, and not because they're bad children, but because they have some issues that they don't know how to handle. And so that's why I'm glad to hear the School Boards Association talk about some concerns with the legislation, which is very legitimate and helpful, but on the other hand, not to say, no, we shouldn't do it. So appreciate that. Any other comments or testimony from the audience? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If not, I would like to move that we, if the committee wishes to recommend Senate File 261
to pass and be
referred to Finance.
To the E-12 Finance Committee. Senator Torres Ray makes that motion. To recommend to pass and re-refer Senate File 261 to the E-12 Finance Division. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Members, we are going to review the department's policy bill now, and I believe you have a copy before you, and we have the staff is here to help us go through it, and They have several people from the different divisions that are responsible for administering these different areas that are included in this bill, and they will be happy to assist if members have any questions. So welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Darren Cordy. I'm on staff at the Minnesota Department of Education. I'll be walking through the MDE agency policy and technical bill. If it pleases the chair, I'd like to work off of the summary just so we can kind of group the sections that are interrelated under, you know, kind of the individual proposals as opposed to jumping around. But if there are specific questions, please feel free to stop me. As the chair has mentioned, we do have some of the subject matter experts who helped develop these proposals here, and they'd be happy to answer any questions that I may not be able to. So starting with Article 1, Section 1, this change, this proposal would require school calendars to include at least 165 days of instruction while maintaining the current hours requirements, which are already in statute. What happened a couple years ago, the change was made from days of instruction to hours of instruction, and as a result of that change, we've had some issues with districts and other schools that have been dramatically shortening their calendar years while maintaining the hours requirement, but that would making changes that would normally be subject to the flexible learning year approval program. So what this change intends to do is to make sure that districts are maintaining a regular calendar year unless they've been approved by the department under the flexible learning year statutes. Article 1, Section 2 is a proposal that was brought to our attention by the St. Paul School District. We believe this is an old relic from when transportation was outside of the general fund, but or outside of the general education revenue. But what this does is allow a district to expend transportation, expend general fund dollars to transport students to PSEO programs. Currently, the law does not permit them to do that. It allows them to spend their transportation budget on it, but if they go above and beyond, they can't provide that transportation. Section 3 of Article 1 is a proposal that would update the allowable uses of operating capital revenue to include computer hardware and software purchases, but it would not allow such revenue to be used for recurring software licenses, such as annual renewal costs, stuff like that. Article 1, Sections 4 through 7 are all kind of interrelated. The purpose of...
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Claus.
Would you like us to ask questions along the way or wait?
That is a great question. Let me ask Mr. Cordy. Would you prefer to have the questions as you leave each article, or would you like them at the end of our time today?
Madam Chair, members, Senator Claus, that'd be fine at the end of each article.
Okay. So we are at the end of Article 1.
I still have to go through, Madam Chair, I still have to go through sections 4 through 7 in Article 1.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. Mr. Senator Claussen, would you mind waiting till the end of Article 1 and then we'll take those questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, as I had said, sections 4 through 7 are all under the same kind of umbrella. These sections clarify that charter school pupils are subject to the truancy provisions of Chapter 260A. This is something that is already current state practice, that we believe that charter school pupils are subject to these laws, but because it wasn't specifically stated in the law, we thought we'd add these sections to clarify that. And that concludes Article 1.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. Senator Claussen.
Madam Chair, thank you. A question going back to Section 3, Item 18. Has to do with hardware, initial purchase, or related software. Is that covered by the levy lease at all? Are those items?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, members, I would perhaps defer to staff on that, but it's my understanding that this is not the only area or fund that schools would be able to make these purchases under. It's just adding hardware, initial purchase, and related software costs to the uses of operating capital revenue, there are other funding streams that they can use to make those same purchases.
Senator Claussen?
I was just wondering, since they're specifically listed, if it would be under the lease levy. So that's why I raised the question, but thank you.
Are there any further questions, members, on Article 1? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back on page 1, I'm just asking about this policy change, number one, in general, and then number two, specifically for a district that I represent that currently is on a four-day week. If I'm understanding this correctly, what we're doing is, instead of just adding the number of seat hours, we're including in there also a minimal number of days as an additional requirement. That's going to reduce a little bit of flexibility for schools. I just wanted you to talk about that a little bit. But then specifically for North Branch School District, which currently has a four-day week, how would this affect them or not?
Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, in regards to the first part of your question, that's correct. You would still have to maintain the minimum number of hours that are required under the current law, but you'd also be required to, you know, spread those hours out over 165-day minimum. You could go longer than that or shorter, as long as you weren't running afoul of the flexible learning year statute. And in regards to your second question, Senator Nino, I believe Northfield, who has been scheduled or approved under a four-day week under the flexible learning year statute, as you can see on line page 1.27 and line 1.28, you're not required to maintain that minimum hours of instruction if you've been approved by the commissioner under the flexible learning year statute, which Northfield has.
Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, I think I just want to clarify. North Branch is what I was talking about.
I'm sorry, North Branch.
Okay, so they did receive that approval already. And then I just want to clarify, maybe correct one thing that I thought I heard you say. You said they could go more or less than 165 days. I think it's only more, 165 or more.
Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, Senator Dean, no, that's correct.
Members, any further questions on Article 1? Mr. Cordy, could you move on to Article 2, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, Article 2, the first five sections of Article 2 are an attempt to reorganize five interrelated statutes regarding state educational expectations for Minnesota students. The purpose of these changes is not to make any substantive changes about what those expectations are, but rather to reorganize the statutes to reduce confusion for parents, teachers, and students, and making clear what the educational expectations are for those students. So Section 1 of Article 2 creates a definition section. Currently, we have a number of definitions that lie across these five statutes, and it takes those definitions would be benchmark, credit, elective standard, required standard, and school site. It moves them into this first definition section and then creates a definition for academic standard. Section 2 of Article 2 reorganizes this area of statute so that graduation requirements are clearly defined under subdivision 2 of that section. And it also takes some language that is currently in this section and moves it into other sections of this bill. So Section 3 of Article 2 strikes some obsolete language that is related to prior year standards revision cycles, and it also removes a content area listings for social studies, as we don't include content area listings for any of the other subject areas. Moving on to Section 4 of Article 2. Section 4 reorganizes the benchmark language. It removes some obsolete language, again, from prior year standards revision cycles. And it moves the academic standards expectations language out of the benchmark section and into the following section, which is the course credits section. So Section 5 will now be called the credit section of the statute. Section 5, in an attempt to clarify what academic standards and how they pair up with the individual course credit requirements. This statute does just that. It pairs the individual credit requirements for graduation language with their respective required academic standards. Again, this removes the content areas that are listed out in the social studies standards to be consistent with the other subject areas. And it clarifies the credit equivalencies. In Subdivision 2 in the past, we'd had some confusion because the credit equivalencies that you could use, for example, using a career in tech ed credit to fulfill your physics or chemistry credit requirement, those were kind of scattered about in the statute. So what this does is takes all that language and collapses it down into Subdivision 2 here. So those first five sections were kind of interrelated. Section 6 is a different proposal. Section 6 does...
Excuse me, yes. Mr. Cordy, I have a few questions.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Regarding the benchmarks, I'm wondering about... I was actually trying to read here. Is there anything in this bill proposal that changes current legislative language that benchmark changes need to be approved by the legislature, that there needs to be legislative authority to change benchmarks?
Madam Chair, if you look on page 8 point or page 8 lines 2.5 to 2.6, that language is right there, and it is not affected by this proposal.
Thank you. And actually, that's enough on the benchmark.
Okay.
All
right. Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Claussen.
I know you mentioned this, but I think I might have missed it. There were some changes made as far as granting credit in science to Project Lead the Way. And could you just reference that one more time? I'm sorry I missed it.
Madam Chair, Senator Claussen, if you look in Section 5 on page 11, starting at line 11, it lists out the credit equivalencies. So as you can see in there, there's a list of how you can use an egg, education, or business department class to fulfill the economics credit, or to use career and technical education credits to fulfill your chemistry or physics credit requirement.
Thank you.
Mr. Cordy, before we leave the benchmarks in this section, I'm looking at pages 8 and 9, and it appears that on page 8, lines 2.27 through 2.29, we are striking language requiring review of academic standards and benchmarks, and I'm wondering if you're replacing that with something else. And my second question has to do then with on page 9, it appears that this bill is striking that students must satisfactorily complete like certain courses like Algebra 1, or they must satisfactorily complete other things. And so talk about this language on page 9 that's being struck and why that is, and particularly also on page 8 then, why we would not want review of our standards.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Cordy.
I've asked Beth Oney, who works in our departments as our standards director, but to answer your first question, on page 8, lines 0.27 to 0.29, the reason that those are stricken there is not to remove any specific requirements for the commissioner, but it's that those we felt that those requirements were redundant with requirements that exist in Subdivision 2, and perhaps Ms. Oney could go into that a little bit more and answer your second question.
Ms. Oney, welcome to the committee. Could you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Beth Oney. I'm Director of Academic Standards and Instructional Effectiveness at the Department of Education. Could you repeat the question that you have, please?
Yes. My question is about page 9, the stricken language that talks, that is removing requirements that students complete, like Algebra 1, by the end of 8th grade. Line 9.1314, we're striking, this bill striking the language that students must satisfactorily complete Algebra 2. Line 9.2 through 2.2, The language is stricken that students must satisfactorily complete the revised arts standards. So I'm sure there's a good reason for that, but just looking at this language here, it looks like we're striking the strength of our standards, which is that certainly students must take Algebra 1, Algebra 2, and they must pass those particular things.
Madam Chair, we have just moved that language to a different area. There are so many problems with people interpreting what exactly is required for graduation because we have requirements scattered throughout different statutes. So that particular question about Algebra 2 and Algebra 1 needing to be completed by the end of grade 8, mm-hmm. Algebra 2 needing to be completed as a condition for graduation, that's found on 10.21 through 10.25. That's where it's included. So it now falls under the credits.
Thank you.
Section.
So simply rearranging,
exactly.
Not deleting. Thank you very much. And Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. This goes back to your original question, Madam Chair, on requiring review of the
Senator Chamberlain, could you use your mic, please? Thank you.
I'm so engrossed here. It goes back to your question, Madam Chair, of the review, developing a review for the academic requirements. And I think the answer to that question was that it was kind of duplicated on the next page. But I think that paragraph, just for insight, paragraph starting at 8.27, I think that's where it gives authority to do the review, where the next page simply says during the review cycle. So it's just a technical thing, but I don't know, am I reading that wrong? You said the second page is kind of a duplicate of 8.27, but it looks like 8.27 is the authority saying you must do it. And the next page doesn't really give authority, just says during the review cycle.
Mr. Cordy.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Tony.
This is struck, this being 8.27 through 8.29 is struck because it is addressed elsewhere. Throughout the rest of 120B023, there's language directing the commissioner to conduct reviews and revisions of the academic standards in specified years. So that was struck merely because it was redundant. As to your issue about authority to conduct the review and revision, the law judges of the past have found that authority not provided in this section, actually, but in section 120B02.
Thank you, Ms. Downey. Senator Chamberlain, did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Cordy, as you continue on, could you help us out? And when it's actual rearrangement of language, maybe just tell us ahead of time where that is, so we don't think that we're striking some of these items.
Madam Chair, I will do that. Thank you,
Mr. Cordy.
So, Madam Chair, if there's no more questions for Ms. Aoni, I'll move on to the next kind of section here in the bill. So moving on to Section 6. Section 6 has to do with gifted and talented programs. What this section requires is it expands guidance that we provide to expands guidance that exists in statutes to gifted and talented assessments, programs, and procedures to help districts serving gifted and talented students, and it also asks them to include in those assessments to take into consideration traditionally underrepresented groups in the gifted and talented student population. And it also requires districts to adopt guidelines for assessing and identifying gifted and talented students and to adopt procedures for early admission to kindergarten or first grade of gifted and talented students. Article 2, Section 7 is just a technical removal of some old language referring to the old basic skills tests, which are no longer administered by the state. Section 8 is part of the educational expectations alignment that we went through in sections 1 through 5. So the language that is stricken there, the cross-reference that's stricken there, is rendered obsolete in this section because of the changes that were made in sections 1 through 5. So moving on to Section 9 of the bill. Section 9 is a large section because it is the charter schools section. As you know, it's a rather large piece of statute. So bear with me as I walk through this, and if I get you lost, just feel free to stop me. So starting with Subdivision 1, one of the things that we had talked about last year in our bill, and also is in this bill, is that it would require all charter school contracts to state as their primary purpose that the charter school's primary purpose is to improve pupil learning and student achievement. This is a change that this is a requirement that charter schools are already to have in their contract. As you can see here, there are five requirements that they have to have in their contract. This would just say that first one, the first one for pupil learning and student achievement, that's the primary purpose. This is a change that is required for us from the feds to continue to receive our current $28.2 million federal charter school programs grant. So moving on, the next change you'll see is on page 17.25. This is just a technical clarification to clarify that the applications referred to here are the charter school applications. The next change you'll see is on page 19.5 to 19.8. This is just old language that is currently not relevant under, this had to do with the authorizer conversion and is no longer relevant after June 30th, 2012. The next change you will see is on page 21.9 to 21.11. This is just removing some redundant language. This language here is redundant with above. You can see where it says the top of the page that you have to identifying and contact information for the school's authorizer available to the public. So that language is stricken as redundant. On page 21.22, we add the word breaks for times when schools, charter schools, are not allowed to hold board elections. Just clarifies that it doesn't need to be a holiday or a vacation, but anytime the school is on break, you can't have a charter school board election. Line 21.24 is a change that we had made. I feel it's a technical change, but it just clarifies that there is a requirement that there is a teacher board member for all charter schools, and it just clarifies that teacher actually has to be employed as a teacher at that school or otherwise needs to be a teacher who's providing instruction at that school under contract between the charter school and a cooperative. On line 21.31, we strike some language here that is redundant to the ex officio non-voting line that is above it. On page 21.11, we remove the word lease here. The reason we do that is because lease agreements are covered in Subdivision 17. We've had some confusion arise about the application of confusion between this section and Subdivision 17, so we strike lease here because it's referred to in Subdivision 17. On page 22.18, now this is a change. If you first look at it, it looks like it does a lot, but actually we need to make an amendment here when the bill actually is in front of you. The word grades should not be stricken on 22.18. So the intention there was just to remove the words to add additional, so it would read, to add additional sites or grades. Simply a technical change. On next line that you see a change on is 23.26. This is some cleanup language that we have to make sure that the conflict of interest language doesn't apply to the teacher board member of the charter school. And again, just clarifies that teacher board member needs to be an actual teacher teaching at the school or providing instruction under a contract. on subdivision 6 there, line page 24.7 through point 9. This is further language regarding the primary purpose, having charter schools have as their primary purpose academic achievement. On lines page 24.18 to point 25, this just clarifies that contracts contain how an authorizer will comply with subdivision 15, which is the review and comment subdivision, and state and local requirements. This was something that was moved from clause 12, which you'll see on the next page. On page 25.5, again, this is language that was required for the primary purpose, issue we had talked about earlier. Page 25.18 to point 20, this is the supplemental audit info that we will be requesting as a department. We would just ask under this proposal that that schools would have to submit supplemental information with their independent audit, including agreements with administrative, financial, and staffing services. And we'd also ask them to include audited financial data of affiliated building corporations or component units. Purpose of this is just to have increased transparency about making sure there's no conflict of interest going on. The next change you'll see is on page 26.26. This is just a cross-reference to the audit requirement that I just discussed. Page 27.16 through 17. This is an addition that was made, as we talked about earlier, to make sure that it's clear that all charter school pupils are subject to the truancy requirements of Chapter 260A. On page 27.33, this would require that if schools have a lottery process in place to determine, school admissions for children, that process needs to be published on the charter school's website. On the next page, 28.4 through 28.12, this is, as we had talked about earlier, with requiring that charter school pupils comply with the truancy provisions. This is to ensure that they're complying with the compulsory attendance provisions of 128.22. The next change you'll see is on 29.14. This just clarifies that boards are responsible for the actions that they undertake. It doesn't really increase any liability that they already have. They're already, held liable for their decisions as board members under Minnesota nonprofit law. On page 29, from point 25 to the end of that section there, this has to do with annual reports. This just requires that charter school annual reports be posted on the charter school's website. And it also eliminates the requirement that annual reports be submitted to the commissioner. Right now, we require that all those reports are submitted. We don't necessarily need all of them to be submitted. So as long as they're on the website and we can access them, then it just makes the whole process a lot simpler for us and for them. On page 30, down line 1 down to point 36, this is clarifying some authorizer fee language. This is just clarifying language. And on page 30.11 to 30.14, this is eliminating some obsolete fee factor scale-up language. Moving down that page onto 30.17, this is just clarifying that authorizers can charge a charter school a fee for a pre-operational planning period, but that they can only charge a fee after the school is chartered. So they can't go back and charge a charter school fees for any pre-operational planning that the authorizer did prior to the school being chartered. On page 30.20, it just requires that income is also included in the statement, the budget statement that is sent to the commissioner. Moving on to subdivision 17 on page 31, line 31.18. This just says that school districts do not need to be eligible to be an authorizer in order to lease land to a charter school. On page 31.24, this states that charter schools must submit an affidavit to the commissioner when they want to expand an existing building using a affiliated building corporation. Currently, they're required to do that for renovations, purchases, or construction of a new facility. So this just keeps it consistent that if you're expanding an existing building, you also need to submit that affidavit. On page 32.26, subdivision 17B, this just creates a new subdivision for the positive review and comment. Kind of felt that this gets lost at the end of 17A, and it's such an important section, we wanted it highlighted as its own subdivision. On 32.33, we strike authorizer and operators and just leave it to the authorizers that they are the ones who and the department who have to disseminate information to the public on how to go about starting up a charter school. I believe the next change you'll see is on page 34.15. Again, on 1.5 and 1.6, this is language that is required to make the changes on the primary purpose that we discussed earlier.
Mr. Cordy, I have a question about that particular. So explain to me what is the difference between failure to meet satisfactory academic achievement and failure to demonstrate. You're using the word demonstrate instead of meet.
Right. And Madam Chair, if I may, I'd like to bring up Cindy Murphy, who's our director of charter school program, and she helped put this proposal together. Maybe she could shed some light on that change.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, committee members, hi, I'm Cindy Murphy, and I'm the charter school director at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thanks for this opportunity to meet with you today. So the specific term demonstrate that we've proposed in that subdivision is really to show alignment as closely as possible with the requirements that we've agreed to with the federal charter school grant program. And so the word demonstrate is aligned with the requirement, and that's why we've added it in that fashion.
Thank you, Ms. Murphy. So what is the difference between the word meet and demonstrate? I understand it's in alignment with the federal language, but what is the difference?
Well, one could offer that demonstrate may provide a little bit more flexibility for an authorizer to determine the exact criteria and conditions that the school is held to. Ultimately, the academic outcomes that a charter agrees to are outlined in their charter contract. And so where meet may imply more of a black and white, demonstrate may provide the authorizers with some discretion to determine what those actual criteria for pupil learning and student academic achievement are.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, moving on, I believe we were on page 36.9 was the next change, and 36.11. This just would make a change that would remove the requirement that the charter schools submit copies of their insurance policies to the commissioner. Again, right now, this is that's something that should be covered by the authorized. They'll continue to receive those insurance policies, and if we have a need to look at them, we will do so through the authorizer. And that is it for the charter school
section. Excuse me for a moment, Senator Johnson.
Yes, I was stepped out for a while and may have missed this, but back on page 29, where we subdivision 14, look at annual public reports. When do these reports? When are these required to be available?
Madam Chair, if I could ask Ms. Murphy to answer that question, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome back, members.
The annual public reports, there is not a deadline in statute, but for the last, I think, decade, those reports have been due to the department on October 1st of each year following the school year that just concluded. The charter school annual report was somewhat analogous to the curriculum report that traditional districts submitted to our department as well, although this report served a little bit additional purpose to inform the authorizer as well as the public about the performance of the charter school. The department no longer collects those curriculum reports for traditional districts, and really we see the annual report as a report to the public by the charter and to their authorizer. And so if we need access to it, obviously it would be posted on the charter school's website if this is enacted.
Thank you. Please continue.
Madam Chair, members, so I believe that wraps up Section 9. So moving out of charter schools and into Section 10. Section 10 has to do with the flexible learning year program. What this proposal would do is allow a consortium of districts to apply using one application for the flexible learning year program. But now we have a couple of different consortiums that when they apply, all schools have to fill out the application. What this would do is say you only have to fill out one application for all the schools, but each of the schools would still have to, or each of the districts, I should say, would still have to go through the evaluation process, including the public hearings and board approval that's required under statute now. Section 11 through 13 kind of work together. These are changes that were asked of the tribal community based upon the Old American Indian Education Act, which, well, I shouldn't say old, it's still in statute, but this was requested updates from the tribal community. So Section 11 requires the commissioner to hold a field hearing on Indian education to gather input from various stakeholders. We had the commissioner held the American Indian Education Summit last year, and it was a great success. It was something that the tribal community really appreciated. It's something that we feel should be continued on an annual basis.
I have a question. What do we do? What happened with those recommendations? Are they incorporated into your requests, or what has happened traditionally with that, other than just providing it to the tribes? What do we do with that information?
Sure, Madam Chair, members, I've got our charter, or our Indian Education Director, Dennis Olson, here. He may be able to answer that question.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Dennis Olson, Director of the Office of Indian Education at the Minnesota Department of Education. Regarding your question, Chair Torres-Ray, the information that was collected, mainly the recommendations from the listening session with tribal leaders in November of 2011 and the Governor's Summit held in January 2012, are actually currently informing some of the changes right now that are being recommended to the Indian Education Act of 1988. Furthermore, we're looking at the annual summit being held prior to September of 2013, actually, and those recommendations paired with a position paper from the tribal nations themselves are going to be pared down to look at specific focus areas for the next summit, and that'll inform the hearing, annual hearing, from there on out.
Mr. Olson, I would like to make a public request for you and the administration to make sure that you let us know about these recommendations, that you let legislators, particularly in our committee, know about these recommendations. Only 37% of Indian kids are graduating from our schools. The overwhelming majority of kids that enter kindergarten that live in poverty are not passing the assessments, and they are not coming ready for kindergarten. It's tragic. What is happening with Indian kids in this state is tragic. And, you know, as an immigrant who came here to listen to these stories for 26 years, and I hear that they are much older than that, I think that we need to do more. And I hope that you can help us figure out what are some of the answers. And I think that these reports could be very instrumental in guiding policy. So I would very much appreciate your work with the commissioner in bringing those recommendations and those ideas to us.
And Madam Chair, members, in that section, it asks the results of the hearing be made available to all of the 11 tribal nations. So maybe when this bill is ready to be heard officially, we can insert something in there to make sure that that information is provided to either the chairs or to the legislature in some fashion.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Section 12, moving on, Madam Chair, is a requirement that the Commissioner of Education consult with the Tribal Nations Education Committee on all issues relating to American Indian education. This was a request that came specifically from the Tribal Nations Education Committee and that arose out of the Governor's Summit that occurred last year. This is something that was formally asked for at the summit, and the commissioner very strongly agrees with this. And if you'd like some more information on who sits on the TNEC, I think Mr. Olson would be prepared to chat about that. Moving on to Section 13, this is a requirement that the commissioner hire and keep employed an Indian Education Director. Obviously, we already have one hired on here, and we're very lucky to have Mr. Olson. But unfortunately, it wasn't always the case that there was an Indian Education Director employed at the department. We feel it's a very important position, and that that position should continue regardless of who's commissioner. So moving on to Section 14, this is part of the educational expectations alignment language that we saw earlier in Sections 1 through 5 and Section 8. What this revisor's instruction does is moves the schedule for standards revision out of the benchmark section and out of the benchmark section of law and into the required academic standards section of law. We just feel like this is a better place for that revision schedule to be if you're looking for it. Seems to make sense. It would be under the required academic standards. And Section 15 is repeal of the old English language arts standards rules. When the new English language arts standards rules were adopted in 2012, the old ones were never repealed, and so this would repeal them. And with that, Madam Chair, concludes Article 2. Moving on to Article 3, if there's no questions. Article 3, in its entirety, is regards technical changes to our Minnesota statutes that relate to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, Part C statutes. So this makes statutory changes that are required for the state to come into compliance with newly revised federal IDEA Part C regulations. And these are regarding early intervention programs for infants and toddlers with disabilities. These new federal regulations went into effect in September 2011. States have until July 1st, 2013 to formally align those policies with new regulatory provisions. Madam Chair, I'll leave it up to the discretion of the chair if you'd like me to walk through individually these technical changes, or maybe I could just point out the more substantial changes for you.
I think we have time if you can go okay. One by one. I think that
Absolutely.
Would be helpful so that if we have questions, we know now. This is our time to ask those questions.
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair, members, starting with Article 3, Section 1, Section 1 is kind of one of the more substantive changes. Right now, the Interagency Coordinating Council, which is created in Section 125A.28, is subject to sunset under current law. What this would do is move it into this section, so it would state that the Interagency Coordinating Council would continue as long as it's required by federal law. Sections 2 through 4 actually make just minor wording changes in order to be consistent with the new federal regulations. Section 5, again, talks about the State Interagency Coordinating Council. This changes some of the requirements of who sits on the council, particularly clarifies that the membership needs to reasonably represent the population of Minnesota and that the council chair cannot be a representative of the Department of Education. And then on page 42.1 to 42.6, This also talks about the annual report that the ICC would be required to submit under the new federal regulations. On page 42.8 to 42.9, again, this states that the committee would not expire until federal law no longer required the existence of the committee. Section 6, moving down to page 42.47. Section 6 makes some federally required changes. As you can see here, it's mostly wording changes to current law and then aligns it with the current code of federal regulations requirements. Section 7 removes a requirement that, and that's on page, well, actually, I'll walk through the actual language here, I'm sorry. On page 44.8 through 44.12, these are just wording changes to align with the new federal regulations. On page 44.22 to 44.24, this talks about the transition plan that needs to be in the individual family service plan, and this just states that it needs to be by the time a child is 2 years and 9 months old, and this is consistent with the new federal requirements. On page 45.4 to 45.13, this talks about the review and comment on the early intervention section of the total special education system. This just removes the requirement that that the intervention committees review that TSES portion. Moving on to Section 8. Section 8 adds a federal regulation citation to definition of the word parent. Starting on page 45.18, all that is clarifying language, adding a cross-reference to the federal regulations, 45.27 to 45.29, adds another requirement to the team as required under federal regulations. And on the next page, on page 46.12 and down to 46.18, again, just some new required changes, wording changes to be consistent with the federal regulations. On section 9, 46.21 to 46.22, again, some wording changes that are added there to be consistent with federal law. 46.34 to 46.35 adds a requirement to clarify about preschool, school, or if appropriate, other services to be included in the IFSP. There's also some new requirements that are added to the IFSP on page 47.10 to 47.16. Moving on to section 10. 47.22 to 47.23. This is a change that reflects current state practice and is in line with the new federal regulations. And on 46.25, it just updates a cross-reference to the new federal regulations. On the bottom of page 47, section 11, there's a change there that strikes the words "and applying for available resources." This is a change that's required by the federal regulations. We strike this requirement because the federal regulations do not allow the state to require parents to apply for MA, or medical assistance. Moving on to page 48 in section 12. This is a somewhat significant change, again, to come in line with the federal regulations. But what this states is that that the mediation process, there's a 30-day clock that kind of starts when the mediation request is received. And this just clarifies that since it's a voluntary process, that mediation request needs to be signed by both sides, the parent and the district. Once that's received, the 30-day clock starts. And then it also states that on page 48.15 to 48.16 that the resolution of the mediation would be binding upon both parties. Excuse me. Section 13 is a this requests expedited rulemaking authority from the legislature to make changes in associated rules required under the federal regulations. Madam Chair.
Could you tell me in Section 13, you know, this bill has to be referred to state government as a result of this particular provision. Could you explain to us a little bit about the need for the expedite process?
Madam Chair, and perhaps I could ask our Part C coordinator to come up and speak to this, but generally the rulemaking authority that we'd be asking for under here is just to align the current rules with the new regulations. It's generally believed that those changes in rule would be non-controversial, which is why we've asked for expedited rulemaking as opposed to the full rulemaking process. But perhaps Ms. Temple could speak to why we need that rulemaking now.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Temple. If you could please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kara Temple. I'm the Part C coordinator for the Minnesota Department of Education, which means I oversee the infant toddler intervention service system for the state. The rulemaking is required due to the federal regulations and some changes that they made to content that is included within our current rule that needs to change in order to become compliant. As Mr. Cordy mentioned, with the change in federal regulations and then the time frame that we had to change policies and procedures in order to continue to receive the federal Part C grant award to pay for these services, our rules have to be consistent with the federal government. And so given the nature of the changes and the requirement, the federal requirement to make the changes, we are thus requesting expedited rulemaking.
Okay, thank you. Senator Johnson?
Yes. Madam Chair and sir, you changed the on line 48, page 48, line 15. The resolution of the mediation is you took out not and put in binding. That seems pretty significant. Can you explain the rationale for it?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, again, this is something that was required under the new federal regulations changes, but I would ask Ms. Temple to maybe address specifically what those regulations say.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are a number of references in the new regulations that refer to decisions of mediation or dispute resolution being binding between the two parties. And as it shows here, the current statute language says that it is not binding, but the federal regulations in a few places are requiring that that decision be considered binding. There's a situation where if there's been a decision on a dispute resolution, but then there is another complaint that comes in following that decision, that the decision of that dispute resolution be binding even with that new complaint.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I've been a volunteer mediator for many years, and that's the one thing about mediation is you can't, at least as I am using it in community and so forth, it's never binding. And, you know, that's the difference between mediation and arbitration and other levels of mediation. And this, so if you have two people mediating, I'm trying to figure it out, and I say, no, I won't do that, and the other person says, yes, I will, no, I won't, yes, I will, no, I won't, what happens?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, it's my understanding that this would only be binding if the resolution, or if there was an agreed to resolution by both parties. If there was no resolution reached at the mediation, then none of the mediation would be binding.
Okay, so the resolution of the binding is of the mediation is binding. Okay.
Senator Franson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to page 47, the change on 47.34. Can you elaborate a little bit? You mentioned that parents cannot request MA?
Madam Chair, Senator Franzen, that's correct, and I'll have Ms. Temple refer to the actual language in the Code of Federal Regulations. But yes, what this would require is that the parent before, you know, that they would be required to apply for additional resources under the current language, and the way that that's interpreted is that they would have to apply for MA. In the federal regs, which we can point to in a second here, they say that you can't, the state can't require a parent who's not receiving it to apply for it.
Thank you. Senator, follow-up?
I'm still confused, because if they qualify, why can't they request it? And aren't we losing, maybe I'm confusing two issues, but if they qualify and then we're losing, I think, the 50% match from the federal government, why is that in place, and can a state do something to make sure we don't lose on that funding? Does that make sense?
Who would like to? Ms. Temple.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the federal regulation document is quite lengthy, and I don't want to waste your time by flipping through to find the specific language. I did not earmark it as I did some other things, but just to give maybe a little background that may be helpful, the districts are required by Minnesota statute to seek third-party reimbursement when possible. The federal regulations state that the school districts need to both notify and obtain consent from the families to access either their private insurance or their medical assistance. And a parent denying consent is not justification for the district to not provide the services that would otherwise be reimbursable through medical assistance. And nor can, even though a child may be eligible for medical assistance either financially or through the TEFRA option, which is based on the child's disability status, the district cannot require that a family enroll in public benefits for the sole purpose of billing for the health-related services through a child's individualized family service plan. It's a protection in there for families. There is a no-cost provision for families in the federal regulations that accessing a family's private insurance or medical assistance cannot result in a cost to the family. Whether it's through caps on lifetime services, co-pays, those sorts of things that would impose a cost.
Senator Kent.
I think Senator Franzen and I were having the same challenge. And so just to make sure I'm clarifying, the issue is that the core services must be provided with no cost to parents, but the additional ones parents can be requested to. So it's the difference between core services and then additional services is the distinction? Because at first reading it seemed contradictory. Does that?
Ms. Temple.
Madam Chair, members, yes, the core services are provided through the districts and at the expense of the district through general education and through the Part C federal funds. What the schools are able to seek reimbursement for are the health-related services such as speech therapy, occupational therapy, transportation, those services that are otherwise covered under the Medicaid state plan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Testifier, I might have questions, but I'll take them offline.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions, Senators? Yes, Senator Nina.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I apparently missed when you talked about this section on page 50, lines 1 and 2. Could you just, what precipitated this was this here?
I think we haven't gotten there yet. So
we haven't gotten there yet.
We were going to Article 4 in a moment, but we had some questions. So we went back to Section 11. We're not there yet, Senator.
My apologies. That's why I didn't hear him talk about it.
No problem. Any other questions about that Section 11? Okay, please continue.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, I believe we left off on Section 14.
Correct.
This is one last section in Article 3 that we repeal a couple of subdivisions that are obsolete under the new regulations that have to do with have to do with a county's maintenance of effort, and counties don't pay anymore under current state practice. So we ask that these two subdivisions be repealed. And with that, that concludes Article 3. Move on to Article 4, which is quite short, just one section. And all this does is a technical change that asks the reviser to change all references to library development services, which is kind of the old term for the what is now the Division of State Library Services. It just asks the reviser to make those wording changes in statute. And Article 5, again, just one section. And what this does is states that early childhood scholarships, that they do not count toward a family's earned income for the purposes of qualifying for Minnesota Care, MFIP, Child Care Assistance Program, and Head Start. And, Madam Chair, with that, that concludes the walkthrough of the bill.
Thank you. Senator Nina.
Madam Chair, I was just wondering, is there something that precipitated this language, federal requirement?
Madam Chair, Senator Nienau, it was just a conversation that I believe our early childhood folks had with our DHS counterparts, in that it was assumed that they weren't being counted as earned income for the purposes. We just wanted to clarify that in statute. We'd already talked with revenue, and for revenue purposes, it wasn't being counted as earned income.
Madam Chair, I don't have a problem with the language. I was just curious. Is this going to have to go through health now?
That's a good question, Senator. I think the determination for eligibility for low income is not changing with this provision. I think we have an additional amount of money that will be given to these families that, you know, are eligible for that. So we're not changing anything in their eligibility criteria. We are just providing a different resource, but they are for the same family. So they could count that as an income, and that, you know, that changes their eligibility criteria, but apparently that's not the case, right? So you just want to clarify. So
correct.
My presumption is we don't have to go to Health and Human Services, but we will ask, Senator. We'll ask staff if you could help us figure out if we need. I understand that the rules may send us to state. I don't know if Health and Human Services will request it, but we will ask the question, Senator. Any other questions, members? Yes, Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back on page 11, subdivision 2, where it speaks to credit equivalencies, I'm trying to recall, is economics, is that a state requirement or a local requirement for graduation?
Madam Chair, Senator Clausen, I would ask Ms. Arnie to come up and speak to that for you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Beth Owney, Director of Academic Standards at MDE. Senator, economics is required in terms of standards development, and it's part of the 3.5 credits that are required for social studies for graduation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? You know, as usual, members, I know that we're going to take these to our offices and just go over again. And I think that we thank the department for going over this and introducing us to your staff. I think that this is very helpful so that we can, you know, through you, kind of get to know the people who are experts in this different parts included in your bill. I think that, you know, any questions, members, that you have, please send them to you know, make sure you contact the department directly. You can contact me. I think for now, I think the bill has been introduced. I don't remember. I think it was introduced today. I'm not sure.
Madam Chair, I don't believe it has been introduced.
Okay. So I think that you're working on that. We're working on that, and we will proceed, you know, with your recommendations, thoughts, anything that you would like to know more about. Please let us know. Okay, members, if you don't have any other questions, we will adjourn for today. Thank you.
Thank you.